Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Just before we get started with today's video.
ASMR.
I'm going to stop. This video is brought to you by Magic Spoon. This is Magic Spoon's first time sponsoring Decoding the Unknown. If you know my other channels, you know that I'm a big fan of cereal, Magic Spoon in particular. Why is that? Well, because they make delicious cereal. Like, I didn't eat cereal for years. I've talked about this so many times. Just because it's like, dude, I'm like a 30-something-year-old man. I don't need that level of sugar. You look at that nutritional information, you're like, oh my God, what is going on? Why are you doing this to my body? Unnamed giant cereal company. Well, Magic Spoon came along and they were like, yo, facts, boy, look, let us hook you up. And they did. They sent me so many boxes. Because I think one time I ate all the cereal that I was supposed to show on screen. And now they send me like, I swear, it's like three times as much as anyone else. I get three huge deliveries of Magic Spoon. Like multiple boxes in each box. It's awesome. And this month there are all new. Oh, what did they say? They were like, we make healthy cereal. It's like delicious and healthy. They say read verbatim due to legal reasons. I got you, Magic Spoon. 0 grams of sugar, 13 to 14 grams of protein, only 4 net grams of carbs per serving, only 140 calories per serving. They're also keto-friendly, gluten-free, grain-free, soy-free, low-carb. I get the feeling that last one wasn't one of the legal things that I had to do, but I did it in that style. You're welcome. They sent me a bunch of new flavors. I haven't even tried gingerbread yet. I didn't even know what this one that I have here is. It's called Honey Graham. I was like, I don't know what that is, but it's delicious. It kind of tastes like a biscuit. It's super good. Oatmeal cookie, a biscuit like a cookie, Americans. I'm sorry. Oatmeal cookie, Waper waffle, had before. My favorite's the cinnamon. Still, Magic Spoon, you keep making these new ones. Cinnamon. Or peanut butter. Not sure. use your authentic voice. I feel like I did. I hope. Call to action. Okay, where do we go? Click the link below to grab a variety pack and try it out today, and be sure to use the promo code DECODE at checkout to get $5 off any order, or go to magicspoon.com/decode. Also, be sure you get cinnamon and peanut butter, and also try this Honey Graham. These are new and exciting. Also, there's 100% money back guarantee, happiness guarantee they call it, so if you don't like it for any reason, you get your money back. You can't lose. magicspoon.com/decode, and now today's video. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Decoding the Unknown. As always, hello there. I'm your host, Simon. What happens here is I have a mystery in front of me, one that I've never read before. This is a cold read. This one, Katie is our normal writer on this channel, our regular contributor. But today's is brought to you by Kevin in a partial effort of mine to attempt to get this podcast / YouTube channel up to 2 videos a week, because I wasn't making enough videos. And I'd like to get it to 2 a week. They're not super long. I think it should be manageable. I rather like making them. I get to sit down and explore a mystery. It's fun. I like being able to do this. Guys, if you are enjoying this show, please do consider leaving it a review if you're listening to it in its podcast form. You could do that on Apple Podcasts. Even now, Spotify has a rating system. So you can go to Spotify. And you can rate this podcast, which the higher you rate it, the more people it gets in front of, apparently. Some sort of algorithmic magic. And if you're watching this on YouTube, make sure you smash the like button and subscribe. Love all of that stuff. What we're covering today, or Kevin has covered for me, is the... I'm going to look up the pronunciation of that. I realize I have no idea how to pronounce the name of this episode. Publius? Publius? Publius. It sounds like Latin, so obviously there's going to be controversy over that. Well, it's not in my pronunciation dictionaries, and that's not a brilliant start. Let's try the other one. There's a backup pronunciation dictionary, which is slightly less good. Let's try that. Also doesn't have it. Well, I'm going to guess it's Publius. Oh, it does have it. In Latin. Hello. Publius. Latin, I just feel like you could say it just like Publius. Publius. I'm just going to say Publius because I don't want to be putting on a weird fake Latin accent. And all Latin accents are kind of fake because we don't really know how Latin sounds. Let's go. Thank you. for years. I will spoil it a little. I've read this one ahead. This was Kevin's first piece, and whenever it's first time with a new author, it's like,
you don't trust me, do you?
I want to read it to make sure it's good, rather than like sitting down doing all this intro and stuff and then being like, oh, this needs work. So I have read this. I will sort of pretend that I haven't, I guess, to keep it in format. I don't know how that's going to work. Let's see. For years, my family have been on the bleeding edge of technology. We got our first PC in the Christmas of 1988 when I was only 6 years old, still 3 years before Windows 3.1 brought a vaguely user-friendly experience to the masses. I'm a little bit younger than you, Kevin, and I remember there was a time even when I remember having early PCs and we didn't have Windows. It was like you could open things up using like DOS. And then it was also a program. It was called like Magic Desktop or some shit like that. It was like a graphical user interface that you could use to control the computer, like, and click on things to open them. But it wasn't Windows. And then Windows 3. Whatever it was came along. And then the first Windows I really remember, like I vaguely remember 3.1 or whatever. I really remember Windows 95 coming along with that start menu and being like, oh boy, this makes things a whole lot easier to use. And still, like, what, 20, 30 years later, we're still using the start menu, which is kind of incredible, the innovation that that was. I remember once they tried to take it away and everyone was like, what the fuck, Microsoft? Are you kidding me? By age 7, I'd already started to teach myself computer programming, albeit at an extremely rudimentary level. I laughed at my father when he brought home a brand new 800 megabyte hard drive, declaring that there was no way we could ever need that much storage space. Tell you what, this episode, what, we're 3-4 minutes in? It's absolutely already well over 800 megabytes in size. Like, one of these, you know, sometimes I'll do half an hour, 40 minutes recording, take it over to my computer, it's like 15 gigabytes. And you're like, I bought a hard disk the other day just because I ran out of storage space. And I was just like, okay, what's like the best, you know, cost to space ratio? 16 terabytes. It was like a couple $100 equivalent. I was like, wow, what a world we live in. Eventually, my brother and I began spending entirely too much time on the computer, so my father reprogrammed it to lock us out. Upon powering on the computer, it would display nothing other than a non-interactive screen that said, cannot be used, Eagle Scout not achieved. For Simon and his UK listeners, Eagle Scouts are like super high scouts, right? I'm saying this like I don't know this, but this is the thought I had when I first read this. And now I know that Kevin's about to explain to me that it's something equivalent in the UK scouts that I also don't know because I was never a scout. You can see the problem when it's like you're trying to cold read a script, but you've already read it. It's like you've literally spoiled everything for yourself. And now I'm like half pretending that I haven't, but I have. I don't know what to do. It's not normally like this.
Why can't you lie to me just once?
That is the Boy Scouts of America's version of the Queen's Badge. No, I knew more what an Eagle Scout is than a Queen's Badge, to be honest. And something my father was very insistent I should attain to put on my college applications. Naturally, we just programmed the computer to circumvent the lock he put on it. In retrospect, Eagle Scout would look much better on my college application than insolent little shit. But hindsight is 2020. I don't know, if I'm an employer and someone's got an Eagle Scout, or they're like, yeah, I'm extremely good at computers. I mean, depending on what I'm hiring them for, whether it's like forestry work or computer programming, probably going to be more interested in the person who's been, like, you know, playing around with computers since they were 2. So, yeah. I guess, I don't know. Do you remember how much we used to care about that stuff? I guess some people still do if you're listening to this. Or maybe some of you are so past it. But I remember, like, how important. Like, we had something called a UCAS application. Right? I guess it's the British equivalent of college applications. And you had to write, like, a personal statement. You put your grades on there. You put all your activities on there. And I just remember how important this was. And he'd be like, oh my God, we'd do clubs just because you wanted to have them on there. Do you like this Duke of Edinburgh expedition where you'd go like hiking and do like charity work and stuff just to put it on you? It wasn't because we felt good about doing charity work or any of that stuff. It wasn't like I went to like these clubs because I enjoyed them. It was just because I had to put it on my bloody UCAS form. And I was like, oh my God, what a waste of life. And how little all of that matters in the, I guess, like, look, I'm speaking from my own personal experience. Like, university wasn't super important to what I'm doing right now. I enjoyed it. It was a great experience. Glad I did it. But, and I guess, like, if you're a doctor or, like, you know, something like that, it probably was really important that you had a good UCAS form and did all these clubs. But I just look back on it now thinking about how much I stressed out about all that stuff and how just utterly unimportant it ended up being. If someone had told me back then, you'll be fine. Don't worry about it. You don't have to do any of this stuff. I'll be like, wait, but what? How am I going to make a living without? And they'll be like, no. None of that university stuff's going to matter for you, fact boy. And I'm like, what do you mean, fact boy? Who's a fact boy? And it would just have been a huge weight off my chest. All this fighting back and forth ceased in 1991, however, when my father brought home a brand new lightning-fast 14.40 kilobit dial-up modem. Yes! Suddenly, we had access to all the knowledge and information of the entire world, and there was no time for petty bickering. I've got 5G on my mobile phone now. I had it for like a year. It still blows my mind. Like, thinking back to when I first got internet, like, what was the one before? I didn't have 14.4, but my first internet was like, was it 28.8? Like the one before 56K, and it was so slow, but it was so cool to have. And now it's just like, yeah, my phone can just do hundreds of thousands of times faster than that. It's just crazy. That was the theory anyway. The internet was a very different place back in the early and mid-1990s. Most of the user experience took place within the walls of the user's particular ISP, like AOL or Prodigy, or in my case, something called CompuServe. If you could even find them, websites were crude and aesthetically displeasing, useful information was few and far between, and a person really needed to know where to look to find what they wanted. The amount of prerequisite knowledge required to find anything on the early internet meant that if you knew how to find it, you probably already knew everything it had to offer anyway. Yeah, I remember once, like, they first got internet at school, and we could use, it was at secondary school, and we could use computers during our break. And I remember we'd just go, you know, around on the internet or whatever. And a guy asked me, he was like, dude, I want to find some cheats for GTA. And I just keep trying to go to, like, he's like, GTA.com, GTAcheats.com. And that's how he's trying to find websites. Because it's like, I mean, I think Yahoo was around. So I was like, my dude, just go to Yahoo.com or Ask Jeeves and type in GTA cheats. And that's going to serve you better than just trying to guess the domain name. But it was really like, we knew nothing. We knew nothing. The internet was so shit. Social interaction was much smaller and more confined as well. Chat rooms topped off at a couple of dozen people. Forums were exclusive to the members of whichever ISP you were subscribed to. There was only one medium back then with which to communicate to large numbers of people simultaneously in a relatively easy-to-find way. Next time you toss some stale bread into the basement, you can tell Danny... Oh, this is a reference for another channel that I do, Business Plays, where the ongoing joke is that Danny is stuck in the basement. My basement. Where I make him churn out scripts. I'll leave whether he is up to your imagination. Tell him I learned from the best, because here, after 450 words, our story truly begins. Yeah, that's... Danny's famous for his very lengthy introductions. Although, Kevin, you got a way to go. Danny's normally span pages. Usenet. Usenet was the first truly popular variation of internet forums that existed. It could be accessed regardless of your ISP, and it could even be set that new messages would go directly to your email inbox. These were also the days before spam and folders with over 9,000 unread email existed. Oh my god, yeah. I have to say, a few years ago, I just sorted it all out and was like, it was just crazy, my email inbox. And I'm just going to sort this properly so I don't have it constantly full. And that worked, and it's still not full to this day, which is nice. So that configuration was not nearly as unwieldy as it would be today. Usenet was made up of a network of news groups, which ranged from uselessly broad in scope to so niche that it was surprising that they had more than one member. Basically, it was Reddit. I've always been a huge fan of music, so when I discovered Usenet and news groups, I was quick to join alt.music.pinkfloyd. Oh, Pink Floyd. Pink Floyd. I got things about Pink Floyd. The news group for my favorite band at the time. Dude... Okay, so everyone loves Pink Floyd. The Dark Side of the Moon, people are like, this is the best thing ever. It's so good. And I was like, really all I knew about Pink Floyd was The Wall. Like the album and the famous song. And I just never really liked it. So I was like, okay, let's listen to Dark Side of the Moon. Let's get really into it. I recently bought a pair of fancy headphones and I got that Tidal, you know, the streaming service and all this stuff. And I'm really listening. And I'm like... I just don't think it's very good. And there's another band I like from the same era that I recently discovered called... oh my god, the name's absolutely escaping me right now. Which is crazy. Fleetwood Mac, who are around same time as Pink Floyd, and I'm listening to their music. This is fantastic. This is fantastic music. This an album which is released similar times to Dark Side of the Moon called Rumours. It's a fantastic album. It's a brilliant piece of music, and so much of Fleetwood Mac is. And I'm like... I feel like Pink Floyd are more famous than Fleetwood Mac. But they suck in comparison. This is just bad. Oh, people are going to hate this, but Pink Floyd just kind of suck. I'm sorry, Kevin. Sometimes there would be information that would be potentially exciting, like reports of the band's set list at various concerts, but being your standard lazy, unemployed 11-year-old, it's not like I had money to buy tickets, no matter how exciting a concert promised to be. Beyond that, it was the same sort of insane fanboying and obsessive analysis that you'd expect to see on r/Star Wars, r/Lord of the Rings, or r/Simon Whistler. And we all know which of the best subreddits is that. It's r/Simon Whistler, which is a genuine subreddit which you can join. This all changed on the 11th of June 1994 when a user posting under the name Publius posted the following message. Okay, so it's just like the format changes slightly. I'm showing people watching, but basically I'll just read it as I, you know, that's what we do here. The message, quote, "My friends, you have heard the message Pink Floyd has delivered, but if you listened, perhaps I can be your guide, but I will not solve the enigma for you. All of you must open your minds and communicate with each other, as this is the only way the answers can be revealed. I may help you, but only if obstacles arise. Listen, read, think, communicate. If I don't promise you the answers, would you go? Publius." End quote. The message came amidst the 1994 Division Bell World Tour. During this tour, Columbia Records flew a nearly 200-foot airship named the Division Bell between concert venues. Also sent a press kit to the media with several general promotional videos, as well as one that simply said, "A spokesperson for Pink Floyd has issued the following statement. You have spotted the Pink Floyd airship. Do not be alarmed. Pink Floyd have sent their airship to North America to deliver a message. The Pink Floyd airship is headed towards a destination where all will be explained upon arrival. Pink Floyd will communicate." Was this post from Publius, very subtly titled The Message, the same message referred to in the press statements? Nah, maybe. Or it's just a crazy dude on the internet. It seemed a bit on the nose, really, but many members of the news group were intrigued and there was a lot of discussion on the matter. But even if it was the message promised by Columbia Records, what did it actually mean? Fortunately for us, Publius made a second post to clarify the message. Quote, "As some of you have suspected, the Division Bell is not like its predecessors. Although all great music is subject to multiple interpretations, in this case, there is a central purpose and a design solution. For the ingenious person or group of persons," I missed a page here, "who recognize this and where this information points to, a unique prize has been secreted. How and where? The Division Bell. Listen again, look again, and your thoughts will steer you, leading the blind while I stared out the steel in your eyes. Lyrics, artwork, and music will take you there." Later on in today's episode, because as you know, I've read it before, Kevin mentions this sounds like a bit pretentious. Really does, doesn't it? So there you have it. And it couldn't be possibly be more clear. Somewhere within the lyrics, album art, and or chord progressions of the Division Bell was a puzzle, and somewhere else within them was the solution. All we had to do was use the combined might and intellect of all the Pink Floyd fans who were nerdy enough to access Usenet and find the answer to the question that we also had to find. It was a daunting task. Or rather, it was a daunting task if it was even real. Remember, this is the early days of the internet, and fact-checking wasn't something that really existed. It was hard enough to find information online back then. Finding a way to prove whether the information was true or not was damn near impossible. Oh my god. Yeah, but we've really come full circle on that one, haven't we? With Facebook publishing its fake... not Facebook's fake news, but allowing the publication of fake news. Just the prevalence of fake news. Absolutely crazy. But it wasn't unreasonable to believe that this puzzle could be real. In the past, Pink Floyd albums had included a satirical backwards message, a prank played on a phone operator, and snippets from impromptu interviews that they conducted. I just don't enjoy that. I'm just like, it's like, maybe I'm just a bit boring with my music, but I don't like that in my music. Although I do really like that Tenacious D album where half of it's like comedy and half of it's music. That's really clever. But with Pink Floyd, I'm just like, this just isn't... I just feel it's just not as clever as you think, Pink Floyd. And maybe I'm just too stupid to get it. But it feels a bit pretentious, doesn't it? But more on those in the bonus fact. The news group was split, and for a solid month, half the members scoured the Division Bell for clues, while the other half told them they were wasting their time on the prototypical queue. Yeah, I was like, this sounds like that fake... The guy from that QAnon conspiracy, which is crazy as well. So, who was right, the fanboys or the haters? Due to increasing skepticism on the community, on July the 16th, 1994, Publius made the following prediction. To validate the trust of those who believe, as well as to reconcile the doubt of others, I have gone to great lengths to plan the following display of communication. Monday the 18th, East Rutherford, New Jersey, approximately 10 p.m., 10:30 p.m., flashing white lights. There is an enigma. Trust. Haters gonna hate, but 2 days later, on July the 18th in East Rutherford, New Jersey, the lights on the front of the stage lit up at approximately 10:30 p.m. to spell out the words Enigma Publius. Publius. That is... Wait, how do they light... Whatever. However, okay. Yes, so suddenly this is way more real than it was before when it could have just been some stupid guy on the internet. Now it's like this guy's connected to the band somehow. Unlike Hugh, Publius had correctly predicted a future event, and since the lights had not done this at any other show, there was no longer any doubt in our minds. There was an enigma, and we were going to find the answer at all costs. Oh yeah, we were also going to find the question too. We still had no idea what that was either. Luckily, we had Publius to guide us. He was going to be there every step of the way to make sure someone, or someones, solved the enigma. Just kidding, after 2 years and very little progress, the Pennet Remailer service, the service used by Publius to remain anonymous, shut down over legal threats to said anonymity of its users. With the service gone, so too was Publius. Posts started appearing from many other addresses, mimicking the style of the original posts, but there was no way to verify if any of them were genuine. All it took for someone to pretend to be Publius was to write some pretentious dialogue designed to make it sound like they were smarter than everyone else. It's not that hard to do, just look at any Tarantino film as proof, yeah. Yeah, there's another thing. I think Tarantino's films are good. God, everyone's going to hate me in this episode. I'm glad they took that dislike button away on YouTube sometimes. But I don't think Tarantino's films are good. Aaron Sorkin blows Tarantino out of the water when it comes to dialogue, though. Right? It's Aaron Sorkin. He's the king.
I don't agree with your assessment.
Yeah.
Don't get me wrong. Tarantino's good. It's just... fine, it's just, it's also super violent. Ponderously not present, the provable ponderously not present, the provable perspicacity, I don't know that word. It's such a small brain. A purportedly Publius posts public progress paralyzed, but surely if someone solved the puzzle, the world would know. The mere existence of the enigma garnered mainstream media attention, with articles appearing in papers like the New York Times and real-life treasure hunts like those found in Masquerade, The Secret, and The Hunt for the Golden Owl. Oh my god, these are pop culture. There's so many... I just don't know these pop culture references. I know none of those. They're newsworthy events. So where is the goddamn treasure already? What we know... considering that even after 27 years we know all about the puzzle itself, let alone the solution, we know a surprising amount about its creation. The first thing we know is that the members of Pink Floyd don't have anything to do with it. I mean, someone at Pink Floyd does, because of the flashing lights, right? That's right, I spent my teenage years trying to find a riddle and subsequent solution hidden in an album that the band didn't even intend to put there. I was already into rock and roll, so I would have been better served getting into sex and drugs instead of this sort of nonsense. That said, we also know that the enigma is real. The band had no part in it, likely because they were too busy writing and recording an entire studio album and then making sure that the world tour went smoothly to do something so convoluted, but they were still aware that it existed. Sorry to anyone who thought that Publius was an internet troll who slips the lighting tech in New Jersey a crisp $20 bill to flash the lights to flash the words at the concert, but it really was a planned part of the show. In 2002, in an interview, guitarist David Gilmour said of the Publius enigma that it was some silly record company thing that they thought up to puzzle people with. Oh no, that's like, you want it to be something cool from Pink Floyd. It's like, Pink Floyd are cool, even if I don't think they're particularly good. But it just turns out to be some like corporate bull thing. You're like, ah, oh, this is like the opposite of cool. Mark Brickman, Pink Floyd's lighting and production designer, also confirms that it came from the record company. Brickman was the man responsible for the words Enigma Publius appearing live in concert, the event that truly escalated this entire search. And he had this to say, quote, I think it really came and out of though. It came out of some guy of Washington, D.C. that used to be with the CIA or FBI or something that was in the encryption game. Oh my god, this is one of those quotes where it's just like directly transposed from like some interview he gave. It'd be like making an article based on what I read, including my asides, and it would be barely readable. Like this. He decided he wanted to do some kind of album cover, and he started talking to Steve O'Rourke. I think what happened was Steve O'Rourke had in his brilliant mind that he was going to try something on the internet because he had been listening to me, and he got this guy, because if you notice, a lot of stuff can't be traced where it comes from. Dude, what is this? Since Simon is probably now asking aloud, Steve O'Rourke was Pink Floyd's manager. Oh, okay. I wasn't. I was just desperately trying to, like, understand the writing. Or, like, read it in a semi-coherent way. Anyway, keep in mind that this was an unscripted statement made during an interview, which is why it borderline sounds like a load of rambling gibberish. Yes, it does. However, it wasn't unfounded gibberish. While we can't say for sure that the originator of the Enigma was in fact ex-CIA or FBI, in a 2005 interview, Pink Floyd's drummer, Nick Mason, confirms the origin of the puzzle and the creators. That was a ploy done by EMI. They had a man working for them who adored puzzles. He used to work for the Reagan administration. His job was then would be in meetings with the president, and when Reagan would say, "Let's bomb these people," he would say, "That's not a good idea, sir." He was working for EMI and suggested that a puzzle be created that followed on the web. The prize was never given out. To this day, it remains unsolved. What's this dude's career path? He's like presidential advisor in the Oval Office with Reagan, and now he works for EMI. I mean, I'm sure working for EMI is great. You get to work for musicians, but that does feel like a bit of a career change, doesn't it? I'm not sure how a person goes from working directly with the president to making puzzles at a record company. Indeed. I like to think that he got fired for suggesting we place a nuclear time bomb downtown Moscow set to explode unless they could solve a series of ciphers. It sounds like something that would be on, like, is it 24? No, there's one, like, it's like, I feel like in that Jack Bauer 24 series, always running around trying to stop a bomb going off in a city or something like that. But what am I thinking of? Ah, the Saw movies, right? Where they're like, I want to play a game. Except this one is, you know, nuclear games rather than just you've got your head in some weird sort of brace that's going to squash your skull. The Saw movies are horrible. I used to go watch them on Halloween with a friend of mine at university. And, yeah, those movies are really, like, I'm not a big horror movie fan. Those movies are really, like, bloody and intense. But considering that Reagan famously joked into a hot mic during a sound check, "My fellow Americans, I'm pleased to tell you today that I've signed legislation will outlaw Russia forever. We begin bombing in 5 minutes." And I was like, really? So I goop when I read this before, because I've read this before. I Wikipedia'd this, and they have a clip. There's a clip on the Wikipedia page of him saying this. And it's like, you can tell he's joking in his tone of voice, and obviously he's joking. There's people laughing in the background, but it's like, dude, there's some things you probably shouldn't say.
"We begin bombing in 5 minutes."
Or whenever I'm around mics, I'm just generally assume they're hot. Like, I'm always around mics, and it's like, just generally assume that they're hot. I have to believe that such a suggestion would not have resulted in termination. However, he made the change in career. My small corner of the internet became a very strange and interesting place for a few years because of it. So, let's recap what we know. Someone working at EMI devised a puzzle and solution based on, at the time, the newest Pink Floyd album release, possibly having input into the album art. This was done all without the participation of the band. So, to craft a riddle around a creative work made by someone else likely resulted in a puzzle so convoluted and abstruse as to be completely unsolvable. We know that as of 2005, well, I bet if that Publius dude hadn't had his anonymous email taken away, he'd have just given more clues until it was solved, right? But the thing that kicked the whole thing over, or, you know, stopped it working, was when that anonymous email service went away and he couldn't prove who he was, and then the internet trolls come in. So they'd have just given more clues until someone would have got it and they'd have got the prize, which, spoiler alert, turns out to be super lame.
"Oh, cookies. Thank you. These look great."
If you're listening to that, you're like, "Oh, but I want to know what the prize was. Simon will tell me." I'd be like, "You're gonna be disappointed." So maybe turn off now. It's you'd be like, "Oh, I'm still gonna listen through, and it's still gonna be, you know, even if it's disappointing, I'm not gonna be disappointed because I'm excited to know what it is now. I'm really not trying to tease this. It's really boring." We know that as of 2005, the mystery had never been solved and the prize remained unclaimed. And that is the most recent official statement that I could find on the matter. So what of the prize? Is it still out there? And what is the nature of the prize? A golden owl, one of 12 keys unlocking precious stones, a golden hair stolen by the author's ex-girlfriends. Oh my god, and another series of pop culture references that I absolutely do not get. Surely a prize like that would make a splash where it found, right? Or is it possible that someone solved the Publius enigma and kept the prize themselves as a secret? Since this is decoding the unknown, what role did ghosts have to play in any of this? If you're so inclined, then I strongly recommend against it. You can watch hours of videos on YouTube of people giving their theories and solutions to the enigma. Most of these videos are just people slowly reciting words from their PowerPoint slides over and over again, as if to say, really makes you think, all while donning the same shirt that they had on since the hunt began in 1994. People reading PowerPoint presentations. High quality YouTube content there. It's bound to do well. Says Rambling Fact Boy. In truth, we may never know if anyone solved the puzzle, because the prize isn't really a prize. Here it's getting boring. In the same 2005 interview where Nick Mason talked about the puzzle's creator, he also revealed the true and brutally disappointing nature of the prize. The prize was something like a crop of trees planted in a clear-cut area of a forest or something to that effect. It was not meant to be a prize of something tangible, but rather a touchy-feely sort of gift that was more of a philanthropic thing than something you could hang on a wall. So after all this time, the real Publius enigma were the friends that you made along the way.
I want my money back right now.
It's like those people are like, it's not about the destination, it's about the journey. Unless the destination is a potentially kick-ass prize and the journey is just convoluted and annoying. I mean, it's like, yeah, a long drive down the M4. It's not about the destination, it's about the journey. What are you smoking? Since there's no prize of any value I can point you all towards, then demand a cut for inspiring your search. This is where the journey ends. If you enjoyed this script and would like more written by Kevin, be sure to get in the comments. Repeat call to action. Kevin, I love how much of a deep pool that is from my other YouTube channel, Business Plays, where I do the ad scripts like really a little bit crazy. They're always like, read verbatim, and then at the end they say repeat call to action, so always read that verbatim. And I also love the fact that Kevin's given himself a plug. I like this so much, I have to say, that I already assigned Kevin another piece. So Kevin will be contributing something else to Decoding the Unknown. I was like, go find more internet mysteries, I love this shit. So hopefully we'll hear more from Kevin. He's got some bonus facts for us though, which is very exciting. Let's go. For my fellow Americans, what actually is a division bell? Dude, I like how Kevin's like, yeah, all British people know what the Queen's badge is. They know what the division bell is. I have no idea. I mean, I do now because I've read this before. It's something to do with Parliament. But I had no idea before I read this the first time. This was one of the first hints that I remember remember Publius giving, and it's something that everyone in the UK probably already knew, that, except for your small brain fact boy. A division of the Assembly, or a division for short, is a means of voting in which members of Parliament physically divide themselves into groups and are then counted. The division bell rings for such a vote and also may ring at the start and end of parliamentary procedures. Fascinating. Number two, remember the backwards message that I mentioned appearing in a previous Pink Floyd work that gave the whole thing a bit of traction before the New Jersey concert? In Empty Spaces on the Wall, there's a backwards message hidden that says, "Congratulations, you've discovered the secret message. Please send your answer to Old Pink, care of the Funny Farm, Chalfont." Many people believe this is a reference to the band's original singer, Syd Barrett. I have no idea how, because I'm not super familiar with Pink Floyd or their history, but fascinating. Number three, at the end of Young Lust on the Wall, there is a recording of a telephone call in which the character Pink discovers his wife is cheating on him. Co-producer of the album, James Guthrie, had arranged to place the collect call to his male neighbor, pretending he was trying to reach his wife. They wanted the operator to genuinely believe she had just caught someone having an affair, so she was recorded without ever being told the truth. The recording on the album was the second attempt, as they weren't happy with the first operator's reaction. Number four, the end of Money on Dark Side of the Moon features a number of people claiming that they were in the right. These were various roadies and studio crew members who were handed a stack of interview cards and asked to answer each before reading the next one. One card read, "Have you ever punched someone?" followed by a card that said, "Were you in the right?" It seems they interviewed a lot of people who felt justified in punching someone else. The iconic line at the end of the album, "There's no dark side of the moon, really. Matter of fact, it's all dark," was spoken by the doorman to Abbey Road Studio. Some celebrities were also interviewed, including Paul and Linda McCartney, but their answers were deemed too fake sounding to be used. Yeah. Okay. I mean, I don't know. I guess these are all interesting to people who really love Pink Floyd. But I'm just like,
Who cares?
Number five. Finally, where did the name Publius come from? Publius was the pseudonym used by Alexander Hamilton, James Madison, and John Jay in writing the Federalist Papers. The name was chosen in honor of the great Roman Publius Valerius Publicola, an instrumental figure in the founding of the Roman Republic. Maybe they just came straight from the Roman Republic rather than via the Federalist Paper pseudonym. Just a guess. I'm guessing our story's Publius thought his title, his little circle of trees, was going to accomplish a lot more than it ever did. It was all a bit pretentious, wasn't it? It'd be like, yeah, look at these clues I'm giving to you. You're going to solve it. You got some trees. Woo! Yay! I was hoping for money. This has been a episode of Decoding the Unknown. If you enjoyed it, please make sure you smash that like button below. Don't forget to subscribe. Yo, if you're listening as a podcast, hello. Reviews make an enormous difference. They help get this show in front of more people, which is something I like, because I like it when people listen to and watch my stuff. It's kind of why I do it. It's fun, but if no one was watching, I probably wouldn't, would I? That'd be a bit weird. I don't want to make any money. Yeah, so there's that. Anyway, I'll see you next time, and thank you for watching or listening.
Seeking the truth never gets old. Introducing June's Journey, the free-to-play mobile game that will immerse you in a thrilling murder mystery. Join June Parker as she uncovers hidden objects and clues to solve her sister's death in a beautifully illustrated world set in the roaring 20s. With new chapters added every week, the excitement never ends. Download June's Journey now on your Android or iOS device, or play on PC through Facebook Games.